This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. Two deaths last year shook the foundations of Vermont's Child Protective Services. Desiree Sheldon and Peyton Girard were two small children whose families were being monitored by the Department for Children and Families. They were allegedly killed by family members. And there have been other children killed since then whose families had connections to DCF. Several investigations into the department revealed significant staffing and funding shortages and a lack of communication among the different organizations that are supposed to protect children, including law enforcement, doctors, and social workers. The legislature has made passing a child protection bill one of its top priorities this session. Shepherded by Dick Sears, the bill passed the Senate unanimously a few weeks ago, and the House has now been taking it up. Today on the program, we are joined by Senator Sears and by Representative Ann Pugh, who's been taking testimony this week in the House Human Services Committee, which she chairs. Thank you both for being on the program.
Thank you, Jane.
Thank you, Jane.
The aim of this bill is obviously to protect vulnerable children, but I just mentioned some of the problems in the system that were revealed in the several reports that came out last summer. As the bill currently stands, Senator Sears, which problems are you particularly attempting to address and correct?
Well, I think perhaps one of the most important sections of the bill is the what I like to call the cone of silence, which I'm dating myself going back to the days of the Get Smart show where Agent Smart and its chief would sit under a cone and it would drop down. And that's kind of what DCF operates under currently. Lack of communication that you pointed out early in your opening remarks regarding with police, with teachers, with law, with other folks who are working with the child or with the family, probation officers, for example. That lack of communication. And what one of the things that S9 tries to do is eliminate that cone of silence, allowing those specific folks to talk about the case, to plan how to best protect that child. And I think that's probably the number one most important part of the bill. A lot of attention's been paid to other parts of the bill, but to me, communication is paramount. And when that happens, better results occur.
So specifically, what does it do in that regard? It requires people to communicate,
and it allows that to happen, but it maintains the confidentiality for the child throughout the process so that it isn't an open to the public type of conversation. And it does create a penalty if the person does give out some of the confidential information, but it's not a major penalty, but it is a fine, and it could result in the loss of a job and et cetera. So that does that. The other part of the bill is that it looks towards removing what we call the hierarchy and allows decision-making regarding the best interest of the child as being the standard that DCF would use and the courts would use, DCF would use in recommending to the courts where the child should be placed. Our examination over the summer and fall with Representative Pugh, myself, and seven other legislators indicated that was one of the other major problems was a lack of using the standard of best interest of the child and too much relying on reunification, particularly when there was a significant substance abuse within the family.
Before we leave the topic of this communication, and I want to get Representative Pugh in here as well, but let me ask you, Senator Sears, since we're on this topic, will parents now have access to case files?
On a limited basis and a need to know, but certainly would have information. Again, that's communication with the child and the family.
And foster parents?
Foster parents would certainly know. I mean, I think the person who's living with a child should have as much information as they can possibly have. But again, all of that is based upon the idea is that the DCF is still the one with the records and can determine what should be remain confidential and what shouldn't.
Yes, because my understanding of the bill is that parents do have some access now to case files,
yes.
Some increased access. I know foster parents have often said they don't have access
right.
to case files, and I was wondering if they are specifically
mentioned.
They
would.
In
They're
it.
Specifically a part of this whole effort to work with the child and do what's in the child's best interest. So, yes, I think, but it's always, I mean, it's limited to what people can have and what is necessary for them. There are certain laws like HIPAA and others that you have to follow.
We're getting some details on a child protection bill moving through the Vermont legislature right now. It's designed to help strengthen the system that protects vulnerable children. Listeners, we'd like to hear from you, especially if you've interacted with the system as a parent, a foster parent, a guardian ad litem, a caseworker. You can tell us about what you think you're hearing in the bill, what you think would protect Vermont's children, and what you think falls short. Our number is 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or post your thoughts on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. Representative Pugh, you've been hearing testimony all week on this bill in your committee. What have you been hearing that's really stuck out to you?
Thank you, Jane. I want to begin by saying I have given everyone who has asked to testify, we have given them four questions and asked them to frame their testimony as it relates to four questions. The goal of S9 is to enhance Vermont's child protection system. The child protection system is not DCF alone. Protecting children is a community responsibility, and solutions need to be community-based. So the questions that we ask is taking S9, because the Senate really did some very incredible amount of work based on an amount of research and input from people that is on some level unheard of in our deliberations. And the four questions were, what sections are essential to protecting children? What pieces in the bill are helpful but not essential? What's missing from the bill in terms of moving the state towards reaching its goals? And what amendments would you propose? What changes might you propose to the sections that are in there? And I would, we're still in the middle of taking testimony, so I don't want to jump ahead of my committee because I don't really know where we all are, but I would concur with Senator Sears that this whole, that when we look at what the issues were, it had to do with lack of communication, lack of integration, lack of collaboration. And some of it has to do with the information flow and who knows what. Others of it had to do with the staffing patterns and number of staff and the ability. If I have a choice between doing an investigation because I just got a call. It's not a choice. I mean, I have to do an investigation. I just got a call about a severe issue of child abuse. Calling a community partner is going to fall to the bottom of the list. In the best of all possible worlds, both would be happening in terms of that. The other piece that rings really loud and true is that the nature of child protection is changing and has changed, and substance abuse, everything from alcohol, but in particular opiates, is an increasing factor in all of the children in need of supervision or CHINS cases. Over 75% have substance abuse as a factor, and that is new. And so we need to be looking at how do we respond to the changing landscape.
And is that part of the bill's purpose in changing or clarifying the definition of abuse or neglect, that issue of substance abuse?
I'm going to turn that over to Senator Sears.
Yeah, and I think that's clearly the goal. I think Representative Pugh makes some good points about it not just being DCF, but a system-wide issue. As we're looking at the budget, I also serve on the Senate Appropriations Committee. The Defender General, who provides services to the children, the courts, the state's attorneys have all come into this system, and particularly law enforcement, and they are all part of this system. It's not just DCF. And the failure, particularly in the Desiree Sheldon situation, was that whole system, including the medical profession, kind of let her down in terms of looking through the hole. And the Attorney General did an excellent, and state police did an excellent investigation into that. And it was very informative into where the system needs to change.
Let's hear from some of our listeners. We have people who have strong thoughts on this subject. Andrea is calling in from Post Mills. Hi, Andrea. Go ahead.
Thank you for taking my call. This is from personal experience with custody cases. The situation we've seen is that the different parts of the justice system don't talk to each other. You may be in there for a family court hearing, and that nobody in family court has contacted the criminal side to see if the people in the hearing have complied with conditions. They may still be under supervision of corrections. They all come in and say, oh, I'm doing fine. You don't get any, there's no official input from criminal court. I think that's a big problem. With DCF, social workers are appointed for the family, and our experience has been that the social worker may end up more of an advocate for one parent rather than being an advocate for the child. There needs to be some separation.
Oh, I think we lost Andrea there. Sorry about that. I'm not sure what happened. Andrea's call dropped, but she was saying that what she's found in her experience is that the caseworkers often seem to be advocates for the biological parents, and she's hoping there will be more of a focus put on the child.
I think I don't want to put words in her mouth. I think her last word was about supervision. And what we did see statewide during our public hearings, we held 9 public hearings around the state, our special committee, which is on, as Representative Pugh said, is unprecedented. But one of the things we heard was a wide divergence district to district of how DCF operated. And I think part of that lends itself to the supervision as well as the turnover in caseworkers, which was extremely high in some districts. Other districts, there was little turnover.
The other piece that I guess I'd like to add is that part of the DCF and other areas, other aspects of state government and the community partners who address child abuse and neglect are not waiting until we pass a bill to look at how they can do things differently, how they can communicate better. And in particular, DCF this summer really took some internal looking at what are some of their operating policies and procedures, and how can they strengthen those, what are confusing. And they've made some changes that did not need a law change to, in fact, perhaps have better supervision, more consistent supervision, and to clarify that first and foremost is child safety. We're talking about child safety and permanence for children, and whether that is in their biological family, a foster family, an adoptive family, but child safety needs to be paramount.
We're talking today about the bill the legislature is working on to address how the state protects vulnerable children. The bill would establish a new crime, failure to protect a child, and it would create another crime punishable by up to 30 years in prison if a person is convicted of having a child in a place where methamphetamine is manufactured. We're going to get into that a little bit. We're also going to talk more about the provisions in the bill and one of the biggest concerns for child advocates, that the system is significantly underfunded and understaffed. Share your thoughts on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net or call 1-800-639-2211. I'm Jane Lindholm, and this is Vermont Edition. We are talking today with Senator Dick Sears and Representative Ann Pugh about the legislature's debate over a child protection bill. It's been a priority for lawmakers after the deaths last year of 2 toddlers who were under state supervision. The bill has passed the Senate, it's now in the House, and we're hearing from some of you as well as you look into what you think would help protect vulnerable children. Our number, if you'd like to weigh in, is 1-800-639-2211. It's 1-800-639-2211. You can also post your thoughts on the Vermont Edition Facebook page. Mark writes, the real elephant in the room here is poverty and the substance abuse issues that are inextricably linked to it. when you have addicted parents trying, struggling, and failing to support children they simply can't afford, you've got a real feedback loop that keeps them and their kids in this downward spiral in and out of state care and supervision. Unless there are actual steps taken to eliminate the underlying causes of this child abuse, then there's no chance that DCF will see a reduction in caseloads. We'll talk a little bit about that in the moment. I want to make sure we get a couple other comments in here as well. Bridget is on the line with us from St. Albans. Bridget, go ahead.
Hi, I'd like to thank both of your guests first for all the work and attention that they've paid on this issue. I find it's really important. I'm a foster parent up in the St. Albans region. I'd like to ask if there's anything in the bill that requires follow-up with families, the biological families in particular, after a child is returned home. So if a child comes into care because of abuse and neglect, what safety measures are put into place to check back in with that family over time again? And I guess I'm concerned because, you know, just a three-month check-in after a child's been reunited with a family may not be enough. So is there a way that we can look out even further? And I know that's just more pressure for DCF considering that department being underfunded and understaffed.
Bridget, thanks for the call. Representative Pugh?
I'm going to turn, in some respects, that over to Senator Sears. I do know that DCF policy has changed in terms of steps that they would take, and that before DCF relinquishes its own custody of a child that has been in residential treatment or been in a foster home, that there will be time at home before, as opposed to returning custody to the parents.
Sort of like
legally.
A probationary period.
Correct.
In a way. Senator Sears,
well,
what about after?
Well, the intent of the bill is that there would be a period of, I hate the word probationary, but there would be a period of time, particularly when there's been heroin addiction or some other opiate or significant substance abuse problems or child abuse problems, that there would be a significant amount of time for follow-up after the child is placed back in the home.
What does significant mean
well,
when you say a significant amount of time?
Usually 12 to 18 months you could continue follow-up. Depends on the court order and how the court deals with that. But I think the intent of the bill, and I can't find the exact section to suggest exactly where one could find it, but certainly our intent was to make sure there is that follow-up, because we do understand that people relapse, people's situations change. For example, in the Desiree Sheldon case, the boyfriend who became the husband is the one who's alleged to have killed her, but is also alleged that may have caused some broken legs and other child abuse injuries that were never really followed up on. So, and our testimony was that the DCF was not aware that he was back in the home.
That's right. They weren't aware that he was a part of the household.
A part of the household,
yeah.
Had married her and et cetera, and married the mother.
I mean, if I just might add, in some respects, what I would say to you is that what you're talking about is what I would call best practice and evidence-based practice, and those. The concepts of that are interwoven in the bill, as well as the sort of requirement to continue to move practice forward and to in terms of what is best practice. So even if something is not outlined specifically in there, I know that that's what the intent is.
Mark mentioned, our earlier listener, Mark mentioned drug abuse and what a problem that is, and underlying stresses of poverty and other issues that are certainly going to need to be dealt with if we're going to be dealing with the child abuse problem, but maybe beyond the scope in some ways of this particular bill. But I want to ask about a provision that does deal with drug issues, and that's the crime that's been codified into this bill as it stands now that makes it punishable by 30 years in prison and $1 million fine, or $1.5 million, if a person is manufacturing methamphetamine while a child is present. That's a very strict punishment, and it certainly, I think, to Senator Sears, what you were saying earlier, is one that's drawn some attention in this
bill. It has, but luckily, and I say very luckily, other than a few pockets, the production of methamphetamine hasn't been a major problem in Vermont the way it's been in several other states, including New Hampshire, West Virginia, and other rural areas. And it is one of the most dangerous things that people can do because it creates toxic chemicals and other things that are particularly dangerous. And our committee, the Senate Judiciary Committee, felt that we needed to make a statement. And I don't know that anybody will ever get 30 years, but making a statement that children should not be present when methamphetamine is being either manufactured or produced.
But one of the criticisms of this bill and of that provision and the similar one, yes, but is that mothers, for example, who are in abusive situations or who are addicted to drugs themselves and may be pregnant may feel more scared to come forward because of this provision.
And if you look at the failure to protect provision, which has come under some criticism, it's a person having care or custody of the child. It's fairly narrow.
So it doesn't make us all mandatory reporters.
No. And knows, well, many people are mandatory reporters, but they wouldn't necessarily come under this because you have to know or reasonably should have known that the child was in danger of suffering death, serious bodily injury, or sexual crimes, that you failed to take any action to prevent the danger, and finally, that the failure to act is a proximate cause of the child's injury. It looks at a case, an actual case in Vermont, where a mother walked in the door, child was being sexually assaulted, walked out, closed the door, and did nothing. She was not under any threat of abuse or anything to our knowledge. It looks at cases like the Sandusky case, where a coach actually saw the child, a child being molested in a shower, and it never got reported to proper authorities. It looks at those types of cases. It provides an affirmative defense if the mother is fails to protect because she's a battered spouse or a person who is, threat of physical harm or whatever. So it provides that. Other states who have this law, the concerns that have been expressed by many advocates about this particular failure to protect standard, we did a lot of research on the other states. I think there's about 25 other states that have this type of law. The ones that don't have the affirmative defense have had all the abuses. The ones who have the affirmative defense, and we copied Minnesota and Hawaii, have not had any record of abuse over the years that this law has been in effect.
And just to clarify for people, just to make sure they were following us, when we first started talking about this part, we were talking about the manufacturing of methamphetamines and the crime to that. What Senator Sears is talking about now, the failure to protect provision in this bill would require somebody who cares for a child to report if that child is being abused. So it basically puts a crime on a caregiver who is witnessing this abuse, may not be the abuser, him or herself, but is not reporting that.
Well, actually knew or reasonably should have known that the abuse was taking place and then failed to do anything to prevent it and was and that failure is a proximate cause of the abuse.
Got it.
So I think it's very narrow. It looks at type of cases like the ones I described and not the general type of case. There has been on the books statute covering cruelty to a child, which is a misdemeanor of 2 years or less and a $500 fine or both. And that has been on the books for years. So that is one that is fairly broad. And if you think about the number of times that those cases have been brought, it's relatively few. So, but that's the broader bill. And given, the state's attorneys, it's been rarely brought.
We got a note from a listener named Deborah who says she represents parents in the child in need of supervision cases. These are what are called CHINS cases, child in need of supervision. And Deborah writes, this bill doesn't protect children, it protects DCF. It provides the state with more power to take children. It deletes any preference for placing children with family members. And it places the state on par with parents in determining placement, an unconstitutional provision given the fact that parents are a protected class under the Constitution and their fundamental constitutional rights are not supposed to be taken away without clear and convincing evidence. The two children who died came into DCF's attention because of abuse. 80% of children in Chin's cases are the subject of alleged neglect, which is such a malleable definition that it has become just what DCF says it is. Because DCF's work is secret, because there's no accountability in the statute, DCF, not surprisingly, has become an organization that is sloppy, inefficient, hypersensitive to any criticism, and even vindictive to families who question their practices. How do you respond about how this bill treats what Deborah is concerned about, that this strips parents of their rights and protects DCF?
Quite frankly, I'd respectfully disagree with Deborah. We have heard from groups with that type of idea. I would respectfully disagree. There are cases, like with any state agency, where there have been cases where you could question and second guess what they did. I don't believe the bill is unconstitutional. We've looked at this very carefully from both the constitutional section, but you can't go to the Supreme Court and say, is this section constitutional? So there would need to be a case brought. But I think clearly that child protection is one of the basic functions of government, which goes back to the funding. Quite frankly, if we fund nothing else, we should be funding protection for our children.
Well, let's go about that, because Representative Pugh, what we found last summer in the reports that came out about these two children, Peyton Girard and Desiree Sheldon's deaths, and what went wrong in the system, one of the things they found was that this system is chronically underfunded and understaffed. And what we heard from the Citizens Advisory report that came out was that there needed to be a lot more caseworkers, a lot more staff on. That would require a lot more money. So of all of these provisions in the law, how are we going to get to a place where DCF has the ability to do what it's supposed to unless it's fully funded? And how does the bill address that?
The bill does not address funding at this point in time. I think that if we have better communication, if we clarify what are the responsibilities, not just of DCF, but of the courts, of the police, of our community partners, of people walking around, average Vermonters, in protecting children, that will be a place to start. I want to say that we don't have enough money. And they're not enough at this point in time, given what we expect of family service workers, DCF workers, there aren't enough. The federal guidelines, and actually we put it in state law several years ago, was to have a caseload of 12. Our committee heard testimony yesterday from two line workers, two people who actually do the work every single day, an investigator through an SIU, and then someone who does ongoing work. And the social worker who does ongoing work said, okay, so I only have 18 families, but 18 families translates to 40 kids, and at minimum, I'm supposed to see those kids in wherever they are living once a month. And then they have therapists, they have all this. So on some respects, they have a really difficult job. The woman caller, I forgot her name, expressed, I think one is too simplistic a description, which is she's putting everything onto DCF. And I'm going to end with how I began. It is not DCF's problem. It is the state's problem. It is the community's problem. And we can't just blame DCF, and we can't just look to DCF for solutions.
Absolutely. And Senator Sears, your last word here on
right.
Because
two things. I just want to point out one thing. Well, we have provided extra funding for DCF. We have increased the social workers. It's one place that has been held harmless from any of the budget cuts. The governor added significant numbers service following the deaths. The second point is one that Representative Pugh brought up that's an excellent point, and that is we have to look at caseload acuity and not just the caseload. Somebody could handle 20 people with no problem. Other people, 5 would be more than enough. So I think it's time to look at the acuity of the caseload rather than the numbers of the caseload. And too often we've just looked at the caseload numbers.
Senator Dick Sears is chair of the Senate Judiciary Committee. Representative Ann Pugh is chair of the House Human Services Committee. They've both been telling us about a child protection bill that passed the Senate and is now before Representative Pugh's committee in the House. Thank you both for talking with us today.
Thank you, Jane.
Thank you, Jane.
Coming up, was a farmer killed in Newbury in 1957 by angry townspeople after he beat his hired hand? Or was his death a suicide that he staged to look like murder? We'll hear the theory of one lawyer and judge who's been ruminating on the case for nearly 60 years. This is Vermont Edition. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. On the morning of New Year's Eve, 1957, Orville Gibson went missing. The farmer from Newbury had been the talk of the town after his elderly hired hand said Gibson had beat him. 3 months later, Gibson's body was pulled from the river. He was trussed up and bloated, but the cold water had kept his body remarkably well preserved. The prevailing wisdom at the time was that Gibson had been murdered by an angry mob of townspeople, had suffocated in the trunk of a car, and then was thrown into the Connecticut River. 2 people were eventually charged in the murder after a local doctor said he'd seen them at Gibson's farm very early on the morning of his disappearance, but they were both acquitted. The case has hung over the town of Newbury for decades now, and it has occupied the mind of Stephen Martin. Martin was a young lawyer representing one of the accused, and now he's published a book outlining a new theory of the case, that Orville Gibson committed suicide and staged it to look like a murder to get back at the townspeople he felt were unfair to him. Stephen B. Martin joins me now. Welcome to the program.
Okay, glad to be here.
Steve, why would Orville Gibson commit suicide, and why would he stage it to look like a murder?
He was a very proud man, and he was very committed to his farm. That was his sole interest, was in developing his farm. And he was very successful at it. His world came apart when, on Christmas Day, the hired man came to work with having had a little wine, and during the course of chores at night, he spilled 2 cans of milk, and the two of them had words over that, and in the process, Gibson struck him and did quite a bit of physical damage to him. He was very upset to be charged with assaulting his hired man, and he was ordered into court. He'd never been into court before. He found it very difficult to handle his 60-cow herd without a hired man during the week. And life was very difficult for him during that period. And the morning that, the morning that he committed suicide, he was going to go see a lawyer up in St. Johnsbury to discuss his case, and he'd called the state's attorney for a continuance of his first hearing, which was granted. And instead of going to see the lawyer, He went down to the bridge, tied himself up, and rolled into the river.
Tell me a little bit more about why you think, rather than just committing suicide, he would have staged it to look like a murder. Because when he was found, his arms and legs were bound, and as I understand it, bound to each other, so he was sort of trussed up. That seems like a lot of effort to go to. Why would he want people to think he was murdered?
Out of anger and revenge, he wanted to show his revenge for the people who were accusing him of beating up his hired man. Of course, when the state trooper came, he maintained that he didn't beat him up. And right up to the time of his death, he took the position that the officer had taken the wrong stance on his case, and he was upset that the state's attorney had decided to charge him with this crime.
Steve, you were part of the team who defended one of the two men who were eventually charged with murder. The team that you were part of presented the idea that Gibson had committed suicide back when the case went to trial.
Yes.
How was it received then, this idea of suicide?
Well, here is the interesting feature of this case. On the day that he disappeared, Gibson's brother-in-law, Freeman Placey, he was called by Gibson's wife to come to the farm when she discovered that he was missing. And when he came, he went over to see Mrs. Gibson, and then he came over to the barn and immediately developed the vigilante theory. He pointed out to the police and the investigators that, look at, see the pail that was crushed? And look at the trail of silage leading from the barn to the roadway. And I bet if we go down to the bridge, we will find some silage down there. And sure enough, he took the police down to the bridge, which is about a half a mile away by walking across the field. And there was silage there. He immediately maintained to the police that this was a vigilante killing, and that's within an hour or two after Gibson disappeared. And, of course, his body wasn't found until 3 months later.
So when you brought the suicide theory to trial, did it seem like it was well-received?
Well, not by the newspapers. Both the Free Press and the Times Argus took the attitude, well, okay, maybe he could have tied himself up, but we don't believe it. By the time that the body was found, the idea of a vigilante theory was well ingrained, and everyone was taking that position. And then when the body actually was found, there was a autopsy taken at a funeral home there in Bradford by Dr. Woodruff, and he announced to the world that Gibson was dead before he went into the water. Well, I would agree that if that was so, that would be a strong, conclusive evidence that he was killed by vigilantes or killed by somebody. But the ironic part is that later on, Woodruff changed his mind and changed his opinion, said, no, he drowned. Now, the other feature of this case, which wasn't brought out initially, was that the authorities went to see two eminent medical examiners, Dr. Ford in Boston and Dr. Spellman over in Philadelphia. And when those two doctors were shown the pictures, their automatic reaction was that it was suicide. And both of them took the attitude that the way they were tied, only Gibson would have done that. They weren't tied in the fashion that vigilantes would do it.
His arms and feet, you mean?
Yeah. And I have been at a number of book signings since the book came out, and at one book signing at Rick Davis, who was Dick Davis's son, he demonstrated how Gibson tied himself up. And at other book signings, I've had my wife do it. It's very simple. It's very easy for someone to tie themselves up in the manner that Gibson did.
I'm talking with Stephen B. Martin. He's the author of Orville's Revenge, The Anatomy of a Suicide. He was a young lawyer working on the case of one of the defendants in this case in 1960. He represented Frank Carpenter. And you think, Steve, that basically this theory of the case that Orville Gibson had been murdered by an angry mob of townspeople just overtook everybody so much that they weren't even open to the possibilities of other theories, like the idea that Orville Gibson had committed suicide. Some people might say, though, the fact that you were so involved in this case, in representing a defendant, makes you a suspect source for an unbiased look at the case and what happened to Orville Gibson.
Sure, of course, I take a view. That's, I can understand that.
All of the relevant people in this case are dead now. Gibson, Welch and Carpenter, the two men who were put on trial. Eri Martin, the hired hand who started all of this, his beating started all of it. And you have had a successful career as a lawyer, then as a judge. You've had a long and storied career in Vermont, and yet this case still lingers for you. Why? Why not just let it go?
Truth. I think people should know what the truth was in this case.
So, Steve, what do you hope happens from your book now?
Well, I hope that people will read my book and people will consider the points that I make, and I would hope that they would arrive at the same conclusion that I have, that he committed suicide.
Well, and for young people, myself included, this case doesn't perhaps hold the same power that it did for a long time. This was a case that went national. People described it as a northern lynching. I mean, this was a huge case in its day. So you bringing this back up and having people read this, this is not just some small case. This was a murder that made headlines, and you're trying to set the record straight.
There you go. I couldn't have said it better.
Stephen B. Martin is the author of Orville's Revenge, The Anatomy of a Suicide. Thank you so much for talking with me.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Pinball. It was a craze in the 50s, 60s, and 70s, but then Tetris and Pac-Man and a wave of video games moved in. The allure of flashing lights, a steel ball, and working the flippers just right seemed to fade away. But what's old eventually becomes new again. There's a group of pinball-playing Vermonters who've revived interest in the game. They recently held a state championship, and we caught up with the winner at the Vermont Pinball Co-op in South Burlington.
My name is Steve Daniels. I'm from South Burlington, Vermont, and I play pinball a lot. I started playing pinball in college, and this was around 1989. Played it quite a bit as a distraction, not too seriously, but I did get a little bit better at it. And then after college, I took a pretty long break in between, and then I think I just picked it up more like 2005, 2006. I like the real physics of it, so interaction with a steel ball and flippers, which are, you know, like bats, but basically it's not something that somebody has programmed as like a video game. It includes a lot of the same strategy as video game. On top of that, there's like a ball that bounces and spins and jumps over the flipper occasionally and does things that can't possibly be programmed. To be the Vermont State champion, it certainly takes a little bit of luck, a good amount of skill, some game knowledge, some strategy, and maybe a little bit more luck than I'm acknowledging. I'm not like walking up to people in the supermarket and saying that I'm the number one ranked player in the state of Vermont or the Vermont State champion, but if people ever want to ask, I'm certainly willing to talk about pinball as much as people want to talk about it. This was the first year that Vermont had a state championship, and so I'm the first Vermont state champion. That entitles me as the champion, along with all the other champions of the states that had championships, to play in the national championship in Las Vegas at the Pinball Hall of Fame, which is a great place and I highly recommend people checking out. I'm really looking forward to it because it's Vegas and it's, you know, national championship. I'm not expecting really good things, but on the other hand, even if I get destroyed in my first round, I'm hoping that there's at least a good chance that I'll at least play my best. I've looked at what the potential brackets might be at this tournament, and pretty much right away, and if not right away in the second round, I'll be playing, you know, people who are top 50 in the world. My favorite machine is Attack from Mars, and we have one here at the Pinball Co-op, and it's just excellent. It has a great light show. It has great sound. I really like the art. Basically, I feel like this game is just ideally suited to me. I've owned games, and there are many games that have deeper rules and things that are more complicated to understand, things going on. This is maybe a medium depth game. To me, it represents exactly what pinball should be.
Such a Steve Daniels is ranked 297th out of 20,000 pinball players in the world. As we speak, he's preparing for his first round match at the U.S. National Pinball Championship in Las Vegas this weekend. VPR's Rick Singeri produced our story. And that's it for today. Tomorrow, the future of Vermont's healthcare exchange. Governor Shumlin announced that the state will drop its health exchange and move to the federal setup if the problems with Vermont Health Connect aren't fixed by the end of May. We'll discuss the likelihood of meeting the benchmarks he's set for the exchange, and you can send your questions to vermontedition@vpr.net, and then be sure to listen tomorrow at noon. Vermont Edition is produced by Patty Daniels and Rick Singeri, with production assistance from Aaron Lucy. Alex Keefe directed the program, and our executive producer is John Van Hoosen. I'm Jane Lindholm. Thanks for listening.